Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind, coming to you this week from Crested Butte, the wildflower capital of Colorado. I am your host, Mark Troutman. This educational personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. Well, I just got back from a wonderful mountain bike ride through the lush fields of flowers. Everything is looking really nice here in Crested Butte. This is a really wonderful time of the year. I'm here for 4th of July parade, which is always pretty cool here. So happy first week of July, everyone. And all finance geeks know what that means. It's time for the semi-annual review, updating all financial statements as of quarter end June 30th. The first thing I like to do is calculate my net worth. And I keep track of that. We've talked about this before. I will reference a previous episode where I walk through how to calculate your net worth. That was the financial starting line. Episode number 3, going back way to the beginning. And because I think calculating your net worth is very fundamental to understanding where you stand financially and also gives you kind of a picture of what everything looks like right now and also after reviewing it, maybe some ideas on how you can improve your net worth and your assets and liabilities and things like that. So just a quick recap of what the net worth statement is. You basically take a piece of paper, you draw a line down the middle, and on the left-hand side, you place all of your assets. I like to divide them into three categories. Category one is cash and cash equivalents, so that would be true hard currency if you have any of that. Savings accounts, checking accounts, and things of that nature. CDs if you have them or anything like that. And then the next section, I like to list investments. So that would be things like maybe a brokerage account, an IRA, a Roth IRA, a 401k, a 403b, anything like that. So you could divide it into kind of the taxable investments and tax deferred investments if you want to. But that whole section contains all of your investments. And the last section is what can be called use assets. So those would be things that are truly have value, a car, a boat, a house, for example, but they're not investments and they're not cash and cash equivalents. So these are really things that you own that have value, but the primary purpose of them is for the utilization of that asset for whatever it's meant to be used for, a car for getting around, a boat for enjoying yourself on the lake, and a house for shelter. And that's basically it. And then you just total up each one of those sections and then total up the entire column of assets. And that's total assets. Very simple. And then on the right-hand side of the page is where you list your liabilities or what you owe. I like to divide it into two sections, short-term liabilities and then long-term liabilities. So short-term would be things like anything that is due within a year. So that would be things like credit cards. That's usually the main thing that is in short-term liabilities. Maybe if you had a loan that was due within a year, that would go there. And then the other category would be long-term, and those would be things like student loans, mortgage, auto loan, for example, any loan that exceeds a one-year time frame. And then you can total up the short-term liabilities, you can total up the long-term liabilities, and then you can total all of the liabilities to get your total liabilities. And then below that is where you place net worth. And net worth is basically a simple calculation. Total assets minus total liabilities equals net worth. It's really just a product of assets minus liabilities. And it potentially can be a negative number. If your liabilities exceed your assets, it will be a negative number. If your assets exceed your liabilities, it will be a positive number. And then what I'd like to do is kind of sit down and look at that and see, are there any improvements I can make, such as Maybe there are some cash and cash equivalents, excess money in a checking account, for example, and maybe you look at your liabilities and you look at them in order of your interest rate, for example. So I've talked about this plenty of times before. I always pay my credit cards off in full, but if you have a balance on your credit card that is not being paid in full at the end of the month, that would certainly be one of the first things to consider eliminating, because those interest rates would likely be your highest by far. And then other liabilities that have higher interest rates than others, they may take priority, and you could look at some of your assets to see if maybe some of your assets could be liquidated to pay off those loans, or at least look at them and understand what are my liabilities in total and what is my plan for paying these off and potentially eliminating them all. Home mortgage typically tends to be one of the last things people pay off because A, it's usually a fairly large number, and B, most likely it has the lowest interest rate or pretty close to one of the lowest interest rates. So home mortgage is usually one of the last things you kind of pay off. And then what I like to do with the net worth statement is I print it out both in kind of detailed format with all of the individual accounts listed, and then I create another version of it, which is more of a summary net worth statement. So maybe all of my retirement accounts that are tax deferred are one number, all of my retirement accounts that are tax free, which would be a Roth, would be one number, and then all of my investment accounts that are brokerage accounts would be one number. So more of a summary net worth statement. I also like to keep this and other documents as well that we're going to talk about in an ICE binder, so in case of emergency binder. So if anything were to happen to me, someone would be able to, my executor if I were to pass away, or a trusted individual if I was incapacitated in some way, they would be able to come in and really see everything in detail, both in the detail net worth statement and in the summary net worth statement, because then it gives them a pretty good roadmap on where to look for things. So I like to have this binder that has my net worth statement. So I update my net worth quarterly. I would suggest doing it at minimum once a year. Some people like to do it twice a year, hence doing it now as of June 30th, halfway through the year. The other thing that's interesting that I like to do, because I do it quarterly, is compare quarter to quarter and just see how have things been going. You could chart this, for example. You could chart your net worth over time. It's not necessarily going to be linear, which I think is kind of interesting. If you look back to March, for example, if you did your net worth statement at the end of the first quarter and you've done it again here at the end of the second quarter, you've probably noticed a pretty decent change if you have investments, for example, because the market had a pretty big dip there in the middle of the year or half year in March and April. And effectively, it's rebounded the whole way. So again, we've talked about kind of staying the course in other episodes. And certainly that was worthwhile doing. So you can see how things have progressed over the year by just looking at your net worth statements. That's why I like to do it quarterly, because you can kind of compare them from quarter to quarter and then year to year. So this is a really good exercise to do. And again, being that it's just past June 30th, perfect time of the year to do it, especially if you're only going to do it, let's say, twice a year. But if you're doing it quarterly, obviously June 30th is quarter end as well. So that's the first thing I like to do in my semi-annual review. The next thing I like to do is kind of review my spending. And the way I do this is I use a program called Quicken, which is, I would call it an accounting program for personal finances. There's also QuickBooks, which is accounting for businesses. But the Quicken product, which I've used for decades now, probably early 90s is when I started using it. So we're looking at 35 years here. I believe the software itself has been around for about 40 years. But I religiously put in all of my spending in there. So at the end of the quarter, end of the month, end of the year, whatever time I choose, it's very easy to just kind of create reports and see my spending history, because I've been putting in all this information as it has transpired. So whenever a charge on a credit card, I put it in, any changes to investment accounts, any activity, I put that in there. It can be done automatically or automated. I don't do that. I actually manually enter everything. I know that's a little old school, but I like to do that. It gives me a little bit more ownership of the transactions. Also, when you're using a credit card and I am putting those transactions in manually, that's my I actually spent that money, where it's so easy to kind of forget what you spend on a credit card. So by putting it in manually, it gives me that kind of ownership of that spending transaction. And so I really like doing it manually. It takes more time than it if I did it automatically, but I feel like it gives me a lot of ownership of all of the transactions. I could probably do the investment ones automatically instead, but I still do those manually. I just kind of just do everything manually. Anyway, so I can create reports pretty easily by just saying, I want to see this time frame. And because I categorize everything in a very detailed fashion, I can see where I spent money in various categories over various time periods. Usually what I'll do is create a report. So right now, for example, as of June 30th, I create a year-to-date report. So it's from January 1st through June 30th. And then I'm having the report show it on a monthly basis. So I'm seeing each month individually. When I do it at the end of the year, I usually just have four columns of quarter one, quarter two, quarter three, quarter four, and then the total for the year. But what I like to do is look at this and say, where did I spend my money this year-to-date period, half year? And is it aligning with my values? And are there any areas where maybe I can make some improvements? Or at least I'm looking at it from the standpoint of really seeing what I spent throughout the year. Because as time kind of moves forward, I think you kind of forget what you actually spent money on, unless you really create reports and look back and see it, and then you can compare it to prior years, for example. So for me, this first half year was quite eye-opening. I mean, I knew where a lot of the spending was, but to see it in this report was pretty stark for me. And the key items were, I did buy a new home at the end of last year. I actually didn't physically, personally move into it until really the beginning of the year because I was away for most of the end of last year. So there were a lot of expenses associated with the new house. I had effectively given away all of my furniture when I sold my prior house. So I ended up buying all new furniture. So that was a big line item for really in January and February. And then one of the things I knew this was the case, but I wasn't really thinking about it. When I bought the house, it is a new construction home and they landscape the front of the house very nicely, but they don't do anything with the back. And so I had to landscape the entire back and I'm not out there doing it myself. So I hired a company that did a fabulous job, but it was a very large project. And as you might expect, there was a very large cost associated with that. So that was a big number for me. Now, I anticipated some of these expenses. And when I sold my prior house, I put some money aside for those expenses. And fortunately, I put enough aside from the sale of my prior home. And the house I sold for more than the house I bought. So there was some excess funds available for these items. So they were funded with those proceeds. So it wasn't something that kind of ate a hole in my budget, let's say. But I am looking at these expenses and saying, well, that was a pretty big number to spend for the first half of the year. Now, are these expenses going to repeat? Unlikely. I can't foresee landscaping multiple times my backyard. I don't see buying a lot of new furniture since I've furnished the entire house already. So these will be hopefully more like one-time items, but it is really good to kind of look back and say, I spent a lot of money in these categories, for example. The other category that was eye-opening for me was my travel bucket. Now, I do spend a lot of money in travel. I have done a number of cruises in 2024, 2025, 2026. I got one scheduled for 2027 even. So some of these expenses are for travel that I completed in the first 6 months of the year. But a lot of the expenses that showed up in the travel category are for trips that have yet to be done. I do everything on a cash basis. For the accountants out there, this is not accrual accounting. This is cash-based accounting. So any of the expenses for things like future cruises, flights, hotels, things of that nature, a lot of things showed up in the first half of the year, but many of those things are for travel that will be in the second half of 2025. Even 2026, and a deposit on a trip in 2027 even. And some of the flights and hotels were for trips that will occur in the latter half of this year and into the early part of next year. So that category was a big one for me this half year. And the other thing I like to do is create another report. So I like to look at kind of year over year, which means that I'm looking at a report, and I can do it for multiple years going back. So for instance, I will create a report that shows what was the first 6 months of 2025, what did that look like, and then create another report for the first half of 2024 and even the first half of 2023 and kind of compare those 3 years for the same time period, the first 6 months of the year, and see how that spending transpired over the years, or maybe where spending shifted. So I certainly know that home expenses were bigger in 2025 than in prior years. My travel category was bigger, but some other items were smaller. So it wasn't a complete offset, but at least I have a good understanding of looking at things on a year-over-year basis. So that's reviewing my spending. So we started off with calculating net worth. The second piece is looking at spending. I don't really budget per se. Now, some people will look at their spending based on what did they actually spend relative to what they budgeted for those categories. I don't actually budget. I track, but I don't budget. The way I kind of budget, let's say, is I pay myself a paycheck out of my investment account. And I live to that paycheck. And for me, I don't really care where that money goes as long as I'm not overspending what I'm paying myself in that paycheck. So for me, it's not so much, oh, I can only spend X number of dollars on food and X number of dollars on utilities and X number of dollars on fun. It's more of, as long as I'm not spending more than the dollars that I'm receiving from my quote paycheck, I feel like I'm fine. And when I was working, I did the same thing. Paula Pant from Afford Anything calls it the anti-budget. And I was very much I don't like to say I'm anti-budgeting, but it's kind of the opposite of budgeting. So what I would do is I would pay myself first. And so put money aside for savings, put money aside for investing, and retirement, things like that. And then what was left over is what I lived on, knowing that all the important things, saving and investing, were taken care of first, and then lived on the rest. Hence the moniker, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. That is the tagline for Mark's Money Mind. And so it's kind of the anti-budget. So I don't really compare my categories to any specific budget targets. I just look at my spending, know that I'm within my allowance or paycheck, however you want to look at it, and all's good. Then the third aspect is looking at that one-page financial plan that I talked about in episode 39, and I'll put the link in there as well. So I have this one-page list of items that is a summary financial plan for the upcoming year. And now that we're halfway through the year, I like to look at, well, what was I planning on doing? What is my progress on those items? And then check them off as they get done. So for instance, for me, one of the things is I always want to max out my HSA contribution. So health savings account, I have a high deductible plan that's an HSA eligible health plan, so I can make contributions to a HSA account. I actually front load that every year. So I put the full contribution in January into that account. So that's already done. I can check it off. But if I was paying it monthly, I would make sure that I was still in line with what my plan was. And if I'm behind, maybe make an adjustment, or if I'm ahead, make any adjustments necessary so that I remain on track. The other thing, now I can't do this because I don't have earned income, but if I was working, I would be looking to do Roth IRA contributions if I could, if my income allowed me to make those contributions. There is an income limit that at some point, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but it's fairly high. If your income exceeds that, you can't make Roth IRA contributions, but many people can. When I was working, I'd like to do those at the beginning of the year, unless it was a year where I thought I might go over the income limit. In that case, I would wait until either the end of the year or even the beginning of the following year, because you can contribute to a Roth IRA up until April 15th for the prior year. So for people that are kind of on the cusp of maybe going over the income limit, instead of having to make a contribution and take it back out and recharacterizing it, which you can do if you're over the income limit, you can't recharacterize, let's say, Roth conversions, and I won't get into that, but there are certain recharacterizations that you can still do, and that is if you go over the income limit, for example, you can move that to a traditional IRA or just take it out of the Roth IRA. So if you're near that income limit threshold, sometimes it's better to wait until you know that you're going to be eligible to make that contribution. The other thing as an employee I would be looking at is my employer retirement account contributions. So what was my goal for the year? Where do I stand on that goal? Am I ahead of the goal? Am I behind the goal? Do I need to make any adjustments? Did I get a raise maybe? Should I increase my contributions? Where do I stand relative to the maximum I'm allowed to contribute? That was one of the things that I was fortunate enough to learn at a very young age, was to max out my 401k. I did that ever since I was in my early 20s. And that's really probably the primary thing that allowed me to retire early, was maxing out my 401k. Every year, that was a huge benefit. So if you can max out your 401k, for example, or employer plan, and maybe you have the opportunity to do that, but you haven't quite gotten there yet, probably haven't if it's only halfway through the year, but you know, see how you stand to be on track to do that, or whatever your goal is for your retirement contributions. The other thing, I don't do this anymore because I don't have a lot of savings goals, because I'm in the distribution period, in the retirement period, but in my kind of accumulation period, I would be looking at any savings goals I might have. So if I was trying to build an emergency fund, for example, or I used to like to make contributions to a savings account for travel so that we could do trips and have already saved the money for that trip without having to figure it out once we got back from the trip how we were going to pay for it. So we would always save in advance for things like travel. If you have a sinking fund for replacing your vehicle down the road, that's another savings goal you may have. So I would kind of look at any of the savings goals that you have in your financial plan, see where you stand. Is there any adjustment you can make? Pat yourself on the back if you're ahead of the game and you're doing well. Maybe check off the box if you've fully funded whatever that savings goal is. Have a little mini celebration for that. In the retirement years, this is something that's on my one-page financial plan. I have different goals for Roth conversions every year. And so what I like to do is I like to do a little bit of a conversion at the beginning of the year that's well within what I think my conversions will be for the year. And then as I get closer to the end of the year, I'll kind of true that up. So why would anyone do Roth conversions? I don't want to turn this into a Roth conversion episode, but like I said, I was maxing out my 401k ever since I was in my 20s. Over time, as you can imagine, with compounding and all those contributions, I had a pretty sizable amount in my traditional 401k, or the tax-deferred part of a 401k. And then if you just leave that there until you're required to take distributions, and for me, that's age 75, you could potentially be faced with a fairly sizable, what's called a required minimum distribution, where the government basically says, hey, you know, it's time to start taking money out of that account. We want our taxes on that money. And if you wait until your required minimum distribution age, which for some people is 73. If you're born after 1960, your required beginning date or required minimum distribution is age 75. So for me, it's age 75. Now, if I were to wait to age 75, that required minimum distribution could be fairly significant and push me into a very high tax bracket. So one of the things to do is, especially when you're retired and retired early and have no other income, is to fill up all of the lower tax brackets with Roth conversions or other income if you have it. Maybe you have a little side income or you have rental income or something like that. I don't really have any income, so I'm using Roth conversions to fill up certainly the 0% bracket, which is the standard deduction amount, the 10% bracket, and the 12% bracket. For me, that's a no-brainer. I do that every year, and we'll talk a little bit about ACA subsidies, even giving up some ACA subsidy to do that, because I feel like the 10 and 12% and certainly the 0% tax bracket is beneficial, and who knows how long we'll have it. It looks like maybe that's going to continue for a while, but that's a pretty good bracket to be paying taxes in instead of delaying down the road until required beginning date or required minimum distribution age of 75 and potentially having a lot of money, certainly in the 0, 10, 12, but also maybe in the 22, 24, and whatever it will be down the road. Potentially tax brackets will go higher or tax rates will go higher because we have a pretty big deficit that needs to be dealt with at some point. So I always like to fill up the 0, 10, 12 bracket and potentially even go into the 22 and 24. I've done that in the past, and I kind of let myself decide at the end of the year how I want to handle that. The downside of doing that for an early retiree, especially one who has their own health insurance like I do, is you potentially can get a subsidy for health insurance if your income is low enough. Now, I've never actually received that because each year either I've done Roth conversions that excluded me from the subsidy, or last year I sold my house that excluded me from the subsidy. This year would probably be the first time that maybe I would get a subsidy. I haven't decided whether I want to get the subsidy, that there would be a very small subsidy for me if I just stopped at the top of the 12% bracket, for example. I think for a single, it's somewhere around $60,000. I would get a very small subsidy. But is it really worth it? Should I just go ahead and fill up the 22 and 24? I haven't really decided yet. Again, I'll let myself decide at the end of the year. But these are some of the tax planning strategies that are outlined in my one-page financial plan. And for most people, having a tax goal, if you have some levers that you can control, which for early retirees, there's a lot of levers that you can kind of manipulate in order to dial in your taxes. If you're a W-2 employee, it's a little bit more difficult because you can't do a lot because that income is going to come through. You can max out your 401k, for example, and that would reduce your taxable income. That's one way to do it. But there aren't as many levers for W-2 employees. But for early retirees, there's a lot of things you can do to manage your taxes. And what you want to think about is, and what I'm always thinking about, is not just managing my taxes for the current year. If I was doing that, I could just do nothing, right? I could do no Roth conversions. I could get a pretty substantial ACA subsidy, but I wouldn't be utilizing that 0, 10, and 12% bracket. And if I don't use that now, I can't go back in time and say, hey, you know what? I didn't use that a couple of years ago. Can I use it now down the road? And if I don't use it, it's very possible that, especially with required minimum distributions, I would be pushed into a very high tax bracket down the road. So I'd rather pay some tax today in exchange for paying less tax in the future. So I'm always looking at my lifetime tax liability, not just my current year tax liability. But again, on the one-page financial plan, it's just thinking about, well, where do I want to fit in the kind of the tax strategy for the current year, with the mindset of how does that affect my lifetime taxes as well. And then the other thing I start doing, and I started doing actually last week, was I start outlining next year's one-page financial plan. So I usually use the current year as the template, and then I start making some adjustments to that. So for instance, for me, this is a unique year. in that I will be eligible for a Social Security benefit as a survivor on my wife's record. My wife passed away, so I can receive a survivor benefit on her record. Now, what I will be doing, because my Social Security is larger than hers, I will delay my own until age 70, but you can claim a survivor benefit as early as age 60 or 50 if you're disabled, which I'm not, so 60 for me. And it's reduced because the maximum would be if I waited until my full retirement age. There are no delayed credits for survivor benefits, so there's no benefit in claiming beyond full retirement age. But my full retirement age at age 67, while I would get more per month, I would only have 3 years of receiving that prior to turning my own on at age 70. So even though the age 60 benefit is much lower than the full retirement age 67 benefit, I will get 10 years of a lower amount instead of 3 years of a higher amount. And if you math it out, it actually makes sense to go ahead and claim. So for me, my birthday is at the end of the year, so I will get 2 months of Social Security this year, Survivor Social Security. So that starts to factor into my Roth conversion strategy, for example. And for next year, I will receive a full year of Survivor benefits, Social Security survivor benefits. So that's also going to change my tax strategy. And the other thing that I can do, and this is also applies to this year and will apply to next year, is that since I'm not a W-2 employee, I don't have any withholding for taxes from a paycheck, for example. So for me, I need to either pay estimated payments, which are 4 times a year, April 15th, June 15th, September 15th, and January 15th. Those are the 4 dates that the estimated payments are due. And the IRS wants your tax liability paid equally over those 4 quarters for whatever your income is going to be for the year. So you kind of need to estimate, well, what is that going to be so that you can make adequate estimated payments. Now, there is a workaround, and that is any withholding counts as if it was received equally throughout the year. So what a lot of retirees will do is they will withhold money from Social Security if they have it, or from IRA distributions. And that can include a Roth conversion if you're over 59 and a half, which I am. I recently had my 59 and a half birthday, and it was funny. There was a celebration on the cruise ship for that. And I think the people that kind of put the little thing together that worked for the cruise ship are totally confused. Like, what is 59 and a half? What does that mean? Anyway, so we had a little celebration for that on the cruise. So anyway, I am over 59 and a half, so I can withhold money from my Roth conversion if I chose to, but usually you're better off paying the tax from a taxable account if you can. So that's what I try to do. And then I also have an inherited IRA, which is not subject to the 10% early withdrawal penalty. So I can withhold money from there if I were to use the inherited IRA. So that was one reason I kept my inherited IRA separate from my own IRA, so that if I did want to do any withdrawals prior to age 59 and a half, there's no 10% penalty from the inherited IRA. And if I wanted to have some of that withheld to pay my taxes, I could do that as well. But once I turned 59 and a half, there was no advantage to having the two accounts. So I combined them as a spouse. You can do that. And so now I just have one IRA that is my own. So my wife's inherited IRA was combined with my own. So now I have my own IRA. So if, you know, hopefully this doesn't happen to anyone in the audience, but if you have a spouse and they die before your age 59 and a half, consider keeping the inherited IRA, if they have one, that becomes yours, separate, so that you can have access to it without the early withdrawal penalty and also any withholding that you want to do from there as well. When I originally notified Vanguard, which is where our IRAs were, they actually were going to go ahead and combine those, because spouses can combine their IRAs. It acts as if it's your own IRA when you have a spouse that passes away. So many custodians just assume you want to combine it with your own. The problem is, if you're under age 59 and a half, there's a benefit to keeping them separate. And I think, you know, most people's spouses pass away after both people typically are 59 and a half. So for most people, they just go ahead and combine them. But that's not what I wanted to do. I know this is kind of getting off the one-page financial plan. But in any event, now that I'm 59 and a half, that IRA is now combined. I don't have the 10% early withdrawal penalty. So if I wanted to make a distribution from my traditional IRA and have some of the money withheld, or do a conversion and have some of the money withheld, then that would satisfy paying the estimated taxes, and I could do it at the end of the year even, and it would count as if it was paid throughout the year. So what some retirees will do is they may do a conversion early in the year, and then they'll do a withdrawal at the end of the year and potentially have as much as 100% of it withheld just for that tax purpose. Now, of course, that withdrawal also adds the income, even though it's all withholding. So you do have to kind of factor that into the math. But some people will do that. Now, my plan is to really pay the taxes from the outside, from a taxable account, so that more money is effectively going into the Roth IRA. So think of it this way. Let's say you're doing a $50,000 conversion from your traditional IRA to the Roth IRA. And let's say you estimate the tax liability on that conversion is $10,000. One option would be to do a conversion of $50,000 and have $10,000 withheld, which means only $40,000 goes into the Roth IRA, but $10,000 goes to the IRS to satisfy the tax liability. The other option is you could do a conversion of the entire $50,000 and then pay estimated taxes out of your own taxable account, savings account, investment account, brokerage account, whatever, and pay it equally in four installments, the $10,000, so $2,500 a quarter, not really a quarter, but on those four dates. And then the entire $50,000 gets into the Roth IRA. You can kind of look at it like this. It's like getting that extra $10,000 that you're taking out of your brokerage account and getting it into the Roth IRA. So if you're doing big conversions and you have the ability to pay the tax from a taxable account, it's really beneficial to do that if you can do that. Now, not everyone can do that. So sometimes withholding is the only option. So it's not a bad strategy to withhold if that's the only way you can pay the taxes. But if you can pay it from the outside, it's usually better. So getting back to the one-page financial plan and next year's one-page financial plan. So for me, I have some income changes. So I need to start factoring in Social Security survivor benefits. The other thing that I've decided to do is when you receive Social Security, you can elect the withholding from that check. And I believe the four amounts are 0, 10, 12, and 22, I believe. So basically the tax brackets, right? And a lot of people will say, well, I don't want to have any money withheld. I'm just going to get the whole check. And then they are faced with a tax liability at the end of the year that they're like, whoa, how come I have to pay taxes? Well, potentially up to 85% of Social Security is taxable. So for me, what I've decided to do, and I haven't called Social Security yet, and I'll talk a little bit about how I have to go about doing that. But my plan is to withhold 22% of that Social Security check, because that will go a decent way of satisfying some of my tax liability for conversions and things like that. And it's just kind of an easy way to have withholding in lieu of paying estimated taxes throughout the year, or at least pay reduced estimated taxes because the withholding is taking care of some of that tax liability. So for people that have outside tax liability, maybe it's investment income, maybe it's conversions, using your Social Security to withhold taxes is a good way instead of having to pay quarterly estimated tax payments. So that's one thing I'm looking at. And then I'm also kind of outlining what my Roth conversion strategy is going to be for the following year. If I have to make estimated tax payments, which I probably will if I do Roth conversions and pay the tax from regular brokerage accounts or savings accounts, I'm going to have to make some estimated payments, even with the Social Security withholding, because my Social Security isn't that large. So the withholding isn't that large either. So that's what I've started outlining. And the other thing I've learned, because my birthday is in October, I can file for benefits as much as 4 months prior, and I should do it at least 2 to 3 months prior to make sure that it gets done in time so that that first payment can be made. And that first payment for me, I believe, would be in November, the month after I turn 60. Whew, it's even hard to say that, but yeah, I'm going to turn 60. So that's what I need to do. And I've also found out that I cannot apply for survivor benefits online. So if it was a regular benefit for myself, I could apply online, no big deal. For survivor benefits, I potentially can do it over the phone. But I've also heard that some of the documents they may need include a marriage certificate, potentially even birth certificates. If you do it over the phone, they may ask you to mail those in, and they say they will return them. But I've heard from others that they don't always return those documents, and they're hard to get back. So if that's the case, I will make an appointment and go into a physical office and show them those documents. Then they can scan them and give them right back to me. So that's the plan. I should be able to do it as of July 1st, which right now it's July 2nd. So I should be able to do that. So I will initiate a phone call and make my appointment, likely in person, unless they say that they can do it over the phone without any paperwork. I've heard that sometimes they are able to do that if you give them all the information. And I was wondering about that. But my understanding is, for instance, the marriage certificate, they can look in public records and find it as long as you give them the day you were married, where the marriage was located, and so forth. They may be able to look it up, not require the marriage certificate. It's my understanding. We're going to see. Hey, I'll keep you posted on how that all goes. Then the other thing I like to do, so we've talked about calculating net worth. We've talked about reviewing spending. We've talked about checking off the items on your current year one-page financial plan, starting to create your one-page financial plan for next year. And then the other thing I like to do is just think about, is there anything I need to update? So estate planning documents, I recently just did my estate planning documents. I redid them after I moved and there were some life changes. So I had those done. So there's not many estate planning things I need to do. I've been thinking a little bit more about who the executors are and how I want to handle that. So I may make some minor changes there, but it can be done with what's called a codicil and not have to redo all of the documents. So I may make some minor changes there. Been giving that a lot of thought. And then the other thing is I like to review beneficiary designations. I like to do it at least once a year, but I decided to just, it's so easy to go online and just see what they all are. And this is another thing that I have on a one-page document that is in that in case of emergency folder, so that if someone had to step in, they could see, oh, okay, A, these are all the accounts, and B, these are all the beneficiary designations and the percentages that go to each one of those beneficiaries. So it's very easy for someone to manage if that ever comes to be. Well, it will come to be at some point, hopefully very distant in the future. And then, like I said, just update that ICE binder, the in case of emergency binder, with these documents, and let the people who would need to take care of that know where they are. Let them know, like, hey, these are the documents. This is where they are. If something were to happen, just go there and you'll see everything. Or even review it with them so they have an understanding of what it is, you know, what their responsibility potentially would be at some point. So that's it for the semi-annual financial review that I like to do. And it's really the same process that I do at least twice a year. I like to do it in January for year end, and I like to do it in July as of June 30th. And then I also do it again after March 31st and after September 30th, but it's not quite as detailed. I really use this kind of mid-year review to really go through things in detail. And certainly the one in January, which is the year-end review, is really the one that is the most crucial in my opinion. So that's how I do it. I hope this was helpful. And I hope you have a wonderful July, July 4th weekend. Don't blow yourself up. Stay away from fireworks. Just enjoy watching them if they have them. We don't always have them here in Colorado because of the risk of wildfires. We'll see if they're going to have any. I'm not sure. Hopefully. I know they've done some like light shows and drone shows before, so sometimes they'll do that instead. But we have this really cool 4th of July parade in Crested Butte. So anyone in Crested Butte, look for me. I'll be out there. And then I'm headed to Camp Fi. So I'm going to Rocky Mountain week one, which is this coming weekend, starting on July 4th. And that goes through Monday. And then there's a new one that was added. There's a week two, which is the following weekend. There's a week three, which is the weekend after that. And then Stephen Boyer of Camp Fi, founder of Camp Fi, decided to do a midweek one this year. So between week one and week two, it's called week 1.5. So because it's back to back, I've decided to stay for that one. So I'm going to do week one and week 1.5. So if you're there, hope to see you. We're going to have a good time. My daughter's going to the first one, the one over the weekend. So I will see her on Friday, and we will have a great time in Camp Fi. And I will bring my recording equipment, and who knows, maybe there'll be a pop-up podcast, and I will publish that episode if and when we record it. Until next time, have a great summer. See ya. Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people find the content in their podcast players. If you would like me to answer a question on the show, please send it to mark@marksmoneymind.com and put podcast question in the subject line. Let me know your first name or let me know if you would like to remain anonymous. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend this show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next time on the Mark's Money Mind Show. Until then, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. Now for the all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on this show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur. So please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.